Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Illegal Motion College Football Podcast. In Nashville, Tennessee, I'm the professor, Matt Perkins. And about a Felipe Franks Hail Mary across the Harpeth River from me, it's our own offensive coordinator, the coach, Corey Burton.
What's up, man? Matt, you might not be able to finish the podcast when I tell you this, but our new featured play, and a play that we really had some great success on, first time we ran it, which was the third play from scrimmage after we recovered a onside kick to start the game. We ran buck sweep and took it 50 yards, and our guy got pushed out at the one.
Nice.
And then we punched in the next play.
Excellent. Well, that's always a good way to start a game.
Then we would go on to that would be the only time we would cross the goal line.
That's not as good.
No, and the other team crossed the goal line about six times.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Coach, but glad the buck sweep's working. As someone who was raised...
We covered the spread.
As someone who was raised in a wing tee offense, I always like to see a good buck sweep. But we'd be remiss if we didn't introduce the third amigo in the second city, a man who thinks that Louisville needs to change their mascot. It's our intrepid blogger from Big Ten and Counting, Josh Cook.
Yeah, I was watching College Game Day. They were talking all about Churchill Downs, Kentucky Derby, and all that. I just feel like Cardinals is boring. It's just a bird. There's a lot of teams with birds. I thought this was the perfect solution. I told you guys about it. The Louisville Thoroughbreds, they have a cool, like, horse head logo. I think it could really work.
Well, my mother's alma mater is actually the Thoroughbreds.
So there's precedent. So it's not
exactly.
Like,
so it's not even. It's not, wouldn't even be breaking new ground. I think they should go for it. But on today's show,
might as well.
Which, by the way, I think this is the first time I've ever suggested a school use a nickname other than the Carthaginians.
Well, yeah, I mean, with the Carthaginians, you get an elephant as a mascot, which is naturally the greatest of the animals. So
exactly, yeah.
Well, today's show, we're going to look back at week three. But before we get to our quick slants, quick picks recap, I want to congratulate my two co-hosts. You both went 5-0 against the spread in our picks this week. Hats off to you. I went 3-2, and that's what I get for picking Boston College and Stanford. So, alas, we made it a clean sweep, though, in our other ones. So, good job to you guys. That brings us on the season. Coach is out to a phenomenal start, 12-3 against the spread in 3 weeks. Josh, you're 10-5. I am way back of the pack at 7-8, but a lot of football still to be played. So with that, we are going to...
Well, Matt, you know the solution for that. Just put Kansas and Nebraska in all the spread formations and you'll be able to start making some money.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we're going to get to Nebraska here in a little bit, but we're going to start off with our spread formations with you, Josh.
Yeah, so my first quick slant is touching in on three teams that are having a nice hot start, and for two of them, really a rebuild, quite frankly. The first is Cal. We've talked about them before on the show, but I think what they did late last night was the most impressive thing yet, holding the Ole Miss Rebels to just 16 points, got that come-from-behind 27-16 victory. They are 3-0 on the young season. And, you know, SC struggled mightily with a not very good Texas team, and they head up to Berkeley next. That would be one hell of an upset. I don't think they can pull it off, but that would really, really make this 3-0 start that much more special. An ACC team that's not Duke, because I know coaches talk about them a little bit, but Wake Forest, also 3-0. They shellacked Utah State this week. The week previously, they went up to Boston College and blew out a fellow ACC team. They're 3-0. And then, obviously, Purdue hung tough with Louisville, dominated Ohio, a really good MAC team that we're expecting a lot from, and then head down to Mizzou and laid an old-fashioned beat down on them, 35-3. Missouri held the ball for just over 16 minutes in that game. It was a thing of beauty.
Excellent. Yeah, that was pretty awesome to see Purdue do so well. You know, we all talked about them a little bit, and we did we did one of our spread formations on them. And, I mean, Brahm has got his turnaround going faster than I think anyone imagined. And I think that by the end of the season, he may have won more games in 1 year than Hazel did his entire career at Purdue.
Well, the biggest difference so far is David Blau in the last two games, zero interceptions. Mm. He had just one game last year with no picks, and since becoming the starter four games into the 2015 season, this marks just the second time in his career that he's had back-to-back games without a pick. His ball security has improved tremendously. If he can keep that up, Purdue can keep at least some of this up. The opposition talent is going to improve once they hit league play, but I don't think the wheels are going to completely fall off.
All right, Coach, what's your first slant?
Well, my first slant, I just jumped on Football Scoop, and I saw this extremely disturbing story that I want to share with you guys, talking about Malik Richmond at Youngstown State. He is a convicted rapist. Like, he actually got convicted of it back in high school.
As a juvenile, yes.
As a juvenile, he got convicted of it. It was all over social media. The actual rape of while he was in high school was actually recorded and shared on social media. Well, he was basically Youngstown State was his third college in 3 years. I guess he had trouble staying at other colleges. And Pelini sought him out and recruited him to come join the team. There was all this backlash, petitions saying he should be thrown off the team. You know, all sorts of people putting pressure on the board of trustees and trying to get him off the team. They ultimately decided that Richmond was not going to be allowed to play in any games this season, even though Pelini intended on that happening. Richmond sued and won the suit and was reinstated back to the team. And then Pelini actually played him. So it's kind of a mess, really, and kind of a PR nightmare that I don't know why you would volunteer for that. It's one thing of like if you inherited this mess and you're dealing with it and you know you're just trying to find the best course of action. But I mean, I don't know why Bo Pelini would welcome this after everything he went through at Nebraska. So I just thought I'd share that and get you guys' thoughts on this story before.
I have a pretty hot take on this, but I want to hear what Josh has to say first.
I mean, I feel like me getting in the way of a hot take is a bad idea, Matt. Let her rip.
If he's done his time and he did his crime as a juvenile and he's eligible to play, let him play. I understand that he was convicted of a very heinous crime, but I don't believe there is a bylaw in the NCAA handbook that states that people convicted of felonies as juveniles are not allowed to play collegiate athletics. And if he is academically eligible and he has served his sentence, I think that it is a violation of his rights to prevent him from play.
Yeah, I'm going to, you know, as I presented this story, my angle actually was why would, you know, because you know there's going to be a circus around it.
Of course.
And you know, I agree with you in that sense, Matt, that he did his time. You know, he paid his debt to society, or at least we think he has. And
well, I mean, the court has said that he has. He has served his time. He has been released, and he has. You know, he's not violating his. I'm sure he has, you know, probation or parole, and you know, he's got a parole officer he has to see. But I don't think it's a violation of his parole to play football.
Yeah, I mean, so yes. Why not let him play? And I don't understand why people are so up in arms about it. That, you know, because when Mike Vick did the same thing. When he served his time and came back to the league, there was a faction of people saying, you know, once criminal, always criminal, you should never let him come back. And then there was a whole, section of people saying, well, he served his time, he paid his debt to society, why not let him rehabilitate and get back to doing what he's good at? And I'm in that camp where if he did his time, then I'm good with that. You know, that's what this justice system is supposed to be about. But, you know, again, I'm like, you know, I feel like Pelini, I don't know the whole story about how he recruited him and what he said to him and whatnot, but I'm just surprised that somebody like Pelini would welcome such a media circus into his program and actually go out and seek it.
See, I'm actually not surprised. I'm not surprised that Pelini did that. I feel like Pelini, of all of the coaches out there, is someone who would actually, not going to say relish that role, but he's not afraid to stand up for what he thinks is right. And he obviously thinks that this young man has earned the right to play collegiate football. So, Pelini's been around long enough. He knows what he's getting into. And while that's a questionable choice for your program as a whole, because it, you know, it's obviously the optics of it are not going to be good.
But, it could possibly, in college versus the NFL, you know, in the NFL, you're paying these guys lots of money. So it's not really going to damage anything. But, you know, in college, your reputation is everything. And, you know, I would be mindful of the reputation that I'm getting because of this and how it might affect recruiting. And that would, you know, that's kind of my angle, is like, you know, how's it going to affect recruiting and is it going to prevent us from getting the guys that we want because, you know, the perception of us is so bad that, you know, they may not, you know, people may not want to come here. But, you know, I agree. I mean, I think he's in a tough spot. I think he should allow him to play. I think he's fine allowing him to play. Me personally, I would not have sought him out if he was already on my team. That's a different story, but I'm not sure I would have, me personally, would have gone and sought him out.
Josh, what do you think here?
So I think that, like Richard said, has paid his criminal penalty and has a right to move on and get his education, attend school. But I think football is a privilege. It's not a right. I think it's 10 months in prison, getting out and getting to play a senior year of high school, then getting to have a free education. I'm not comfortable with that. I think University of Youngstown State, or excuse me, Youngstown State University, I think they can admit him to school. I think they can say, hey, look, like, education is the step forward. This is how he enters the job force. This is how he doesn't become another criminal statistic. We open our doors to him to become more worldly. But, I mean, it just feels like, you know, the victim in the crime, you know, is she getting to lead her life? Is she getting to have all of her hopes and dreams and aspirations come true? I mean, you know, Malik Richardson pans out and becomes a multimillionaire, and we have another Hardy on our situation. Who is it benefited for him to get all these opportunities? Football's a privilege. It's not a right. And that's kind of how I feel. To coach's comment about him, you know, why would you open your program to this scrutiny? I got to be honest, if, you know, when Iowa was going through this with Pierre Pierce, our basketball program took a big hit. Fans were not in the seats. People were pissed, and it was the beginning of the end for Steve Alford. And, like, you know, there's ramifications. He broke the law. And I get that he spent his 10 months in prison, but it just, you know, this is a game at the end of the day.
So I guess one thing I would I completely understand your viewpoint. One thing I would like to push back on, though, is that if it's his right to get a higher education, football is the way that he can pay for that education. And he don't believe he comes from a family that has a whole lot of money. And I don't think he could afford to go to Youngstown State otherwise. So,
but there are other cheaper options, you know.
True. No, that's absolutely right. So I think that this is a difficult subject in a lot of ways. And I'm glad that Coach brought this up, because I think this is a discussion that is going to be ongoing, especially in the wake of everything that's happened at Baylor, everything that has been going on with recruiting violations at, you know, other schools and
Well, I was going to say, for, you know, an opposite perspective, you know, an experience that none of us have had, Brenda Tracy, who is a rape survivor and activist, she's on the NCAA committee to combat sexual violence. You know, she would know the most about this. And her comments on it that were on Twitter were basically, the survivors are now forced to watch their rapists chase their athletic dreams and do it with thousands of people cheering them on.
No, and that's a completely legitimate and valid.
And she also added this, which I also like. And she says, you know, in another tweet, she said, I wonder how guys kicked off their sports team for Brad Grads and smoking weed feel watching rapists and batterers play instead of them.
That is a great question, but that is going to be
especially since marijuana is starting to become legal in a bunch of different states now. That's something that, you know, you look at, you know, in Georgia, you get a guy kicked off for marijuana. You look out of Colorado, and they can do it legally. So it's all becoming, as the world changes, you know, the NCAA is going to have to evolve with it and have to figure out how to best run their institutions and provide bylaws for these kind of things. You know, this is a situation that will set a precedent for some sort of ruling somewhere down the line.
And I think I think you're right. And I think this is a great topic for us to sort of, I think we should dedicate a show or a series of shows to this in the near future. But for today, though, we're going to have to keep moving on, because there is a lot more to discuss from what happened on the gridiron this past weekend. So I'm going to take my first quick slant very quickly, and that is to discuss the two games that I spent the most time watching this weekend. And that was, there goes the freight train by my house.
Hey, Purdue heard us talking about them.
Hey, man, listen.
Yeah. Purdue, boiler up.
Boiler up is right, man. They deserve that. So the first one of these, the earlier game, Wisconsin at BYU. Wisconsin was completely dominant. They had more than twice as much time of possession as BYU. More than 40 minutes for Wisconsin, less than 20 for BYU. Wisconsin racked up nearly 500 total yards, held BYU to 179. It was another phenomenal game from Wisconsin's offense, especially the much maligned Alex Hornibrook set school record in completion percentage at 94.7. He completed 18 of 19, and the one incompletion he had was a bobble drop that the receiver Danny Davis should have caught. Threw for 4 touchdowns, no picks, an almost perfect quarterback rating. Jonathan Taylor getting the job done again on the ground, 128 yards and a touchdown. Wisconsin ran for 235 yards as a team. The receiving core really stepped up, and it's the younger receivers now for Wisconsin that are really starting to do some work. Danny Davis, true freshman, caught a 50-yard bomb over two defenders. That was a truly spectacular catch. Quintez Cephas, true sophomore who was originally committed to Furman to play basketball, had two touchdown catches for the first time in his career with more than one score. He had five catches for 54 yards. A.J. Taylor caught his first collegiate touchdown. He's a true sophomore out of the St. Louis area who was a prize recruit for the Badgers last year. And Troy Fumagalli, another game, another touchdown for the All-American tight end. Wisconsin defense was absolutely smothering BYU. It didn't help that Bo Hodge was making his starting debut for BYU under center. He had no touchdowns, two picks, went 11 for 20 for 111 yards, and just was kind of lost all day. BYU, you know, was without obviously their starter Tanner Mangum, which you could tell that their offense was quite dysfunctional. They tried to get the running game going, but once Wisconsin put eight in the box and told, you know, it's basically telling BYU, come on, try to pass, we dare you. They could not pass at all. Also, want to give a quick shout out to Dante Carrier-Williams, career high eight tackles for the redshirt freshman corner. He's the nickelback for the team, but he was an absolute playmaker for them. So that was really great to see, especially with a couple guys out on injury. Wisconsin has a bye next week before they start conference play with Northwestern. The other game, obviously, that I was following very closely was the Kansas State-Vandy game, which I was supposed to go to. My wife and I ended up not going to the game because of a couple complications. So we stayed home and watched it on the couch, and boy, was it a good one. These two teams have – they both have outstanding defenses. Vanderbilt's defense was truly outstanding. They held Jesse Ertz, the very good Kansas State quarterback, to 10 of 28 passing for 76 yards and two interceptions and no touchdowns. A truly fantastic performance from Derek Mason's defense. You can see why this team is going to be one that is going to be need to be reckoned with in the SEC East, quite frankly, with how poorly South Carolina played. And I know Coach is going to get to them a little bit later. You've got to, I think you can make a case that after Georgia, Vanderbilt might be the second best team in the SEC East. Kyle Shurmur was an efficient 14 for 23 for 205 yards and a score and through the air. They had a tough time getting things going on the ground. They averaged only 2 yards a carry as a team. Ralph Webb, 21 carries, 46 yards. Not exactly his best day, but Kyle Shurmur added a touchdown on the ground. And, you know, the only thing that the Commodores had a tough time stopping was the Jesse Ertz running the ball for Kansas State, but that was mostly in the first half. In the second half, they really sort of amped up the pressure and were able to contain him. Kansas State runs a lot of quarterback sweeps with Ertz, and they were really able to suss those out and prevent him from getting to the cutback lanes. And so that was really key for Vanderbilt. But the huge, huge day for a couple of Vandy players, Emmanuel Smith, the senior linebacker, and also and Ladarius Wiley, a senior safety, combined for 23 tackles between the two of them, 12 and 11 each. Jawan Williams had three passes defended, and, you know, just they were – the Vanderbilt defense was everywhere you looked. And, you know, this was, quite frankly, it looked like a home game for Kansas State. Two-thirds of the crowd here in Nashville were Kansas State fans. You saw them everywhere if you were out and about on Saturday here in downtown Nashville. And, you know, it didn't matter. Vanderbilt was awesome. They busted out their new classic look helmets. And honestly, I thought they looked pretty darn good as well. So they look good. They played good. And a great, great win for the Commodores, who are kicking off a very difficult stretch of games. They follow the Kansas State game with here's a nice little murderer's row for you. They've got Alabama next week, followed by Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, and South Carolina before they get a non-conference game against a good Western Kentucky team and finish the season out with regular Kentucky, Mizzou, in Tennessee. So it's going to be rough. It's going to be tough sledding for them going forward. But, man, Derek Mason has got to love where his defense is right now. So I don't know if you caught any of the game, Coach.
Yeah, I was doing a lot of flipping. I was watching Georgia and Stanford. Georgia started kind of slow, but that was to be expected with the type of game they had last week at Notre Dame. But every time I flipped over there, they were in commercials, so I never really got to watch any of it. So it was weird because I was watching Clemson, Louisville, which we'll talk about later, and then you know, I was watching a little bit of LSU, Mississippi State, which we'll talk about later as well. So I guess I'll just go ahead and take my next quick slant. My next quick slant is going to be kind of ADD radio. And when you said they were going to play regular Kentucky, Kentucky was all but regular in the fourth quarter when they got their – they actually won their fourth straight over South Carolina. Benny Snell had two touchdowns in the fourth quarter. They had some key defensive stops. And this is the first time they started 3-0 since 2010. So Deebo Samuel had a 68-yard touchdown catch. You know, they kind of shot themselves in the foot after that with an interception and a fumble on their first possessions. And,
well, Coach, you're bearing the lead here. Deebo Samuel broke his leg in the game and is now out for the year.
I know, and it's it's I guess it's good for Georgia that he's not playing because he would no doubt. I mean, you can't really cover him or tackle him, but you know you hate it for the kid because he plays so well and he's done so many good things. But you know, the Gamecocks are they're talented. They'll find a way to bounce back. But you know, I'm just I was kind of impressed with what Kentucky was able to do defensively and how they were able to just to withstand that initial surge that was brought on by Kentucky or by South Carolina. They were able to withstand all of that, hang in there, and get the win. Not only get the win, but get the win, what, on the road. So it was a good game for Kentucky, a good game for Mark Stoops to kind of build momentum there in the Eastern Division. And no doubt that kind of leaves Vanderbilt sitting there on that island in the East. And we'll get more into Vanderbilt later. They might become one of our deep roots next week. We don't know. But, you know, some other games I wanted to kind of point out. Let's all rejoice in the fact that Nebraska lost to Northern Illinois. It seemed like they couldn't stop throwing interceptions.
Huskies represent.
And Huskies, the Mac attack is what they call them. Maction.
Yeah.
Real quick question for you guys. How many interceptions is Tanner Lee up to this season and for his career?
I'm going to go with 7 on the season.
Okay. Coach?
I'm going to go with 5.
Matt, you win it. He has 7 interceptions. Coach, you got his touchdown number. He's got 5 TDs to 7 picks. Jeez. His career, he's sitting at, any guesses?
17.
How many games has he played?
He's been... So by 2014, he had 330 attempts. 2015, he had a little bit under 300, and he's up to 120 attempts this year.
I'm going to say he has 22 interceptions in his career.
All right.
I'm going to say 18.
He has 28 touchdowns and 28 interceptions.
Oh, Jesus.
That's what happens when you're a two-lane quarterback. Go to the Big Ten. Oh, my goodness.
Also, some other things, some other scores I want to get to. The first game of the day that was running up against that thriller in Memphis was Oklahoma State Pitt. It seemed like Oklahoma State, Josh, some funny texts from you on that game. It seemed like they were on pace to score 98 points. Well, they stopped at 59 because I think they just ran out of time. Pittsburgh threw up a respectable 21, I guess, to make it cosmetically better. But my goodness. Was Oklahoma State was on and Pitt was off. It was a combination of both. Virginia Tech putting up 64 on our beloved Purple Pirates of East Carolina, winning that one 64-17. Josh Jackson was 24 of 31 for 372 and 5 touchdowns.
Yeah,
Baylor.
I like that little 57-0 run that Virginia Tech went on.
Yeah, it was nuts.
They were down 17-7. I mean,
yeah.
And then
they just lit it up. Dub Bears, they lose again. I guess karma is really ravaging them. But Duke is 3-0, 34-20 victory there. Sean Wilson had 18 carries, 176, and 2 touchdowns. Zach Smith was, get this, he was Baylor's top performer. He was 12 of 34 for 263 and 3 touchdowns. Wake Forest putting it up on Utah State. Wake Forest is 3-0. They won 46-10, and I get it. It's Utah State, but again, we're talking about Wake Forest here. They're not exactly world beaters. North Carolina running up the score 53-23 on ODU. Syracuse finally getting off the getting back on track. Notre Dame 49-20 over BC. I know, Matt, you're happy about that.
No, because I wanted both teams to lose. I wanted a Beamer 0-0 tie somehow.
And double overtime to get it. Brandon Wimbush rushed for over 200 yards and four touchdowns in this blowout. They had a 21-point fourth quarter to kind of solidify that 49-20 score. So Notre Dame getting back on track after Georgia shut them down a week ago. And then also a couple service academy games. Air Force kind of gave Michigan all they wanted in their matchup, and Army was no match for Ohio State. Ohio State getting back on track there. The Georgia Samford game again. Georgia started slow, but they won 42-14. Samford, actually, I really like Devlin Hodges. They're talking about pro potential for him. He was extremely efficient, 26 of 35 for 227 and a pair of touchdowns there for Devlin Hodges of Samford. Samford's going to be they're going to be a tough out in the Southern Conference there in the FCS, which is, I think, what, NAI?
It's Division IV. They made a new division in college football.
Oh, they did. That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So A&M getting the A&M getting the pimp cane going, 45-21 beat down with the Raging Cajuns. So, what's sad about that is that 45-21, you think, okay, good. We're back on track. We scored 45 points, albeit against the Raging Cajuns. We're feeling good about ourselves. Kellen Mond was 21 of 34, 301, three touchdowns. Now, that's not the story from that game. The story from that game is one of the A&M players was given the double middle finger to some of the home crowd.
Well, because they were losing at halftime when they went into the tunnel.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I would give the double finger to the Texas A&M crowd.
Yeah, I don't necessarily blame him, but you're just like, God Almighty, man! You finally get some good things going, and that's all anybody ever wants to talk about.
All right, Josh, what's your next slant?
Oh, I'm gonna talk about my Hawkeyes in North Texas. Truly bizarre game. North Texas 13 penalties for 119. Iowa did their best to chip in six penalties for 63 yards. The refs just were abysmal for both teams. Iowa, on their first apparent score, they ruled that it was coming loose before he went in the end zone, and then it rolled out the end zone, so it was a touchback for North Texas. I've watched the replay about a dozen times, and to me it looks like the ball is still in his hand. His knee is down in the end zone. When the ball came out, none of the North Texas players reacted like it was a fumble. And they say, like, inconclusive evidence that you have to let the play stand. We need to figure out, like, a shot clock on the refs, because they reviewed it for about 5 minutes. And then finally we're like, okay, it's a fumble. Well, if it takes that long to figure it out, then it clearly wasn't obvious. So that was annoying. And then Akram Wadley does, like, the smallest of high steps at the 6-yard line, negates a 74-yard touchdown, and fine. That's the letter of the law. That is an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty. Fine. But when North Texas scored their touchdown, about half the team was hushing the crowd, which last time I checked, that sounds like a coordinated celebration, which is also an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty. So why is one a penalty and the other's not? Because the refs are terrible. North Texas held on literally every play. That was their blocking scheme, was to just tackle our offensive line. Or hey, man,
if that works, if the refs aren't going to call it, it's a great blocking scheme.
But at the end of the day, Iowa overcame their own gaffes, let's give some credit to Seth Littrell. North Texas was game. They played a lot better than expected in that first half. So Iowa overcame themselves. They overcame North Texas. And they overcame what was frankly a terrible officiating crew for both teams to just take the air out of the ball, dominated time of possession, over 40 minutes of possession. They had two extremely long drives. They had one drive that was almost 9 minutes. In the second half, they just hammered North Texas with 59 rushes for 238 yards, used their size and their strength, just used sheer brutality to overcome North Texas. And the defense posted a shutout in the second half, held North Texas to 0 of 6 on third down. It wasn't the prettiest game, but, we don't know what Iowa's going to end up, but I always feel like good teams find a way to win when it seems like everything's going against them. And who knows where Iowa ends up, but, at least they found a way to scratch and crawl. See, this is what happens when we do a podcast late at night.
Scratch and claw?
Out of victory. Woo!
Woo, you're right.
Green Bay is trying to scratch and claw their way out of Atlanta and try to get this game over with as quickly as possible.
I believe the correct phrase is scratch and craw.
Victory. Scratch and
Josh,
cruel.
Josh, stuck in your craw?
For those of you listening at home, I did not just have a stroke. I'm just kind of tired and tripping over my words.
Well,
I wasn't even doing a Lou Holtz impersonation.
Oh gosh, if you were, that would make me more unintelligible.
But long story short, I hope North Texas and Iowa don't have to ever have those officials again. I don't know where they found them, but they were dog do.
All right. Well, my second quick slam is going to be a very early hot seat watch. So, we're three games into the season for most teams, unless you're Florida State and you've only played one game. But I
wanted to Hawaii and you've played eight.
This is true. So I want to take a look at who is on the hot seat. So I eliminated coaches who've only been who is either their first or second season at the school. So we're looking at coaches who are in their third or later year with their school. So before I get to my top five, I've got three honorable mentions, or I should say dishonorable mentions. The first, Mark Whipple at UMass. His first tenure at UMass from 98 to 03, he was great. He went 49 and 23. Over six seasons, including three conference titles and one national title in 98 after he came over from Brown. Second tilt at UMass, not so much. Midway through his fourth season, in his second go-around at UMass, he is a lovely 8-32, including 0-4 this season. Things are not looking great there in Amherst. Second dishonorable mention, Larry Fedora. They came back a little bit this weekend, I should say, with a nice victory at Old Dominion. But still, definitely not as great as things were a couple seasons ago when they went 11-3 and won the Coastal. Regressed to 8-5 last season, and that was with having the number 2 overall draft pick at quarterback. And this season they're 1-2 on the year with some pretty rough losses and a tough schedule coming up. And my final dishonorable mention is Steve Adazio, who their team is regressing absolutely. He went from
Matt, regressing implies that they were ever decent under him.
They were a bowl team even last year.
Okay, going 6-6 and making the Michelin Tire Ottawa Canada Bowl doesn't count.
It's a Quick Lane Bowl. Don't get it twisted.
Your mom's a Quick Lane Bowl. What?
Whoa there. I don't think Aunt Sally will appreciate that about that way.
It's pretty safe to say we're not going to get that Quick Lane endorsement
fee. No, probably not. Yeah. But it's okay. Yeah. So
they're not going to sponsor the show.
Now for my five hottest seats. In fifth place right now, I have Kevin Sumlin at Texas A&M. Coach mentioned their game this past weekend. It was ugly in the first half before they finally turned things around. They had trouble last week as well. They won that first game. They lost that first game against UCLA in very rough fashion. His record every year has gotten either stayed the same or gotten worse since his first year at Texas A&M in 2012, where he went 11-2. He's gone from 11-2 to 9-4, 8-5, 8-5, 8-5, 2-1 this year. But in again loaded SEC West, you've got to imagine that, I think they're looking at probably a 500 finish. You got to assume they're going to lose to Alabama, Auburn, Mississippi State, and probably LSU at this point. But we'll talk about LSU a little bit more later. In fourth hottest seat, I've got Gary Anderson at Oregon State after he made the less than lateral move from Wisconsin to Oregon.
Do they care though?
Yeah, I think they care a little bit out there. I mean, under Mike Riley, they were winning seven. You know, they would usually win between 6 and 8 games. In his 3 seasons so far, he is 7-21. Like he's in his third year. They're 7-21, 3-15 in conference. That's bad. What's that?
At least they were competitive with Washington State.
Oh, geez.
Not looking good out there for the Storm and Mormon. Number third hottest seat. The top three, honestly, could all be tied for number one. I've got Butch Jones at Tennessee in my third hottest seat. That was a rough game. We're going to talk about that game against Florida here in a little bit. But, good for him that he's gone 3-0 in bowl games. But, 32-22 in 4-plus years is
not when you've recruited as well as he has.
No. Quite frankly, they expect better at Tennessee. And, it's not going so great there right now. I think they are at best the fourth best team in the SEC East right now, Coach. Would you say that? At best the fourth best team? Maybe the fifth?
I'd say the fourth.
I mean, I think at this point you've got to put Florida, obviously. Georgia, Florida, and Vanderbilt, I think, are all ahead of them at this point. They're probably on par with South Carolina.
He's on the hot seat, but I mean, I don't know if you could definitively say that Florida is better than that. Game was a dead even game until one busted coverage. I mean,
true, but they still lost. And and at the end of the day, it's going to come down to wins and losses.
I know.
And it doesn't help that he's kind of gruff and is not great with the media. The players don't seem to really enjoy him all that much. So
no, I got my opinions on Butch Jones. I'll talk about it when we get to the Florida Tennessee game.
Okay. Well, my second hottest seat, I've got our old friend Bluetooth.
Oof.
Yeah.
Wait, he's still around?
Yeah, man, it's not around, but it's not looking good. If you'll remember, 2013, 2014, he had some pretty good teams, back to back 10-win seasons, including a Pac-12 South championship in 2013. Made to the Holiday Bowl, but
wasn't that back during the Kiffin experiment and the height of probation for USC?
Yes, and that was
before
Jim Mora got things going at UCLA.
Did he get things going?
Well, we're gonna talk about UCLA, but it's been diminishing returns since. He's looking at a third straight losing season, and
they are incredible. I mean, they are. I don't think Arizona State's ever been like completely relevant, but they have never been this irrelevant.
No, they haven't. I cannot remember a time they've been this.
By the way, based on UCLA and Arizona State's defense so far through 3 weeks, when they face each other, bet the over.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could put the over at 100 and I'd still bet it.
Bet the over.
But I think at this point, the consensus hottest seat in college football has to be Mike Riley. It is. Things are going south fast there in Lincoln. I mean, you're losing to Northern Illinois at home. It's not a good look. They were competitive in the second half of the Oregon last week, but they got waxed so bad in the first half that it didn't even matter. Nebraska would be Josh in the Big Ten West. Who are they underdogs to when they play? Wisconsin?
Yes.
Iowa?
Yes.
Minnesota?
For opening impressions, big time, yes. Minnesota has looked really, really good.
Northwestern?
At this point, yes.
I think at this point they might be, if it's a coin flip game at best.
Yeah.
They're going to have trouble with Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
They can't cover anyone. And they turn the ball over a lot. And if Blau keeps not turning the ball over, well, I mean, there you have it. I mean, it's, you know, I don't think that, I'm not sure if he's going to last the season, because you know Nebraska people, they expect, I mean, they got rid of Bo Pelini after he went 9-4 basically every single season. So
I know message boards are never a good way to determine a fan base. I know they were pretty pissed off, so they might have been a little steeped and confused over their words, but the message boards were pretty funny. My favorite one was one person was so pissed. They were saying, look at Wisconsin, look how consistent they are. We need to get Wisconsin's athletic director. And he was talking about how they need to back up a truck to whoever Wisconsin's athletic director is. Didn't know the name. Probably would have helped to Google that, considering it's Barry Alvarez.
Who's a Nebraska alum.
And he's the all-time winningest coach at Wisconsin and is a lifer in Madison and will not be leaving.
No.
But other than that hypothesis, another message board person wanted Scott Frost, who they claim has been doing incredible work at USF. So other than not knowing what school he's at.
Yeah, he's got those USF Golden Knights playing. They're going to win the Division II national championship at the FCS level. That's great.
I mean, a lot of their fans are still debating if they should have even fired Bill Pelini. So,
I think the answer has got to be a resounding no at this point. I mean, Pelini took Youngstown State to the FCS NAIA. Division 4.5 championship game last year.
I think it's a false equivalency, though. I think based on, I think it was fine firing Bo Pelini. The problem was who they hired.
Well, if
but of I course mean, the first the, other, thing, the other issue though is like Bo Pelini won a lot of games. He never won fewer than 9 games.
Yeah,
so, like what coaches are going to be like? Ooh, that sounds like a good school to go to.
He was solid, but never great, and that's why they fired him, because they expect great, and he never got him there.
They're going to be pandering for Chip Kelly. I think.
Gross.
Well, yes.
Hey, you know what? Honestly, the way Oregon kind of fell apart without Chip Kelly and how bad he did in the NFL, like, that really doesn't scare me as much as it would have 5-6 years ago.
What do you mean by that?
I think he's a fine coach. I think we're probably overstating his talent. I think that Stanford wasn't nearly as good yet. Washington was certainly not as good yet.
No.
I'm curious how Oregon with Chip Kelly right now would fare in the Pac-12.
Well, that's an interesting hypothetical. But so I think, though, right now, Mike Riley's has the hottest seat in college football. Anyone I miss, guys?
Well, one name you might have missed was what I was going to say about Chip Kelly, which is, you know, kind of shades of Rich Rod. Like, you know, Chip Kelly was awesome at Oregon in that one snapshot, but, like, you know, there's a reason why he didn't make it in the pros, and there's a reason why no one's hired him yet again.
That's true. That's true.
Because he costs too much dang money.
Well, we are going to move on to a new segment, which is going to be our little trivia break before we go to our deep roots. So, during the telecast of the Wisconsin BYU game, Tommy Tuberville, who is not the world's best color commentator, stated that it was an interesting matchup because it was a matchup between two schools who have coaches that are coaching their alma maters, Paul Chryst and Kalani Sitake.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, there are currently, including Chryst and Sitake, 23 coaches who are currently coaching at their alma maters. We're going to do this in the style of Stump the Schwab, one of the great shows that ESPN never should have canceled, and they just never should have fired Howie Schwab either. I will never forgive them for that. So we're going to go back and forth, starting with you, Josh. Name until there are no coaches left or you guys run out. All the coaches in FBS football who are currently coaching at their alma mater, and I'm spotting you, Chris and Sataki. There are 21 left.
Okay. So Mark Richt at Miami.
Correct. Coach.
Kirby Smart at Georgia.
Correct. Josh. There are two in the Big Ten. Two more in the Big Ten, I should say, Josh.
There are two in the Big Ten? Oh, man.
Three, including Christ.
I mean, I wouldn't even have known that. I'm going to go with Edo at LSU.
Edo is not a graduate of LSU.
Perfect. See, I don't know these. This is not...
Pat Fitzgerald.
Correct.
Pat Fitzgerald at Northwestern.
Correct.
Jim Harbaugh at Michigan.
Correct.
Yeah.
there are two in the Big 12.
Oh. Hold on. Mike Gundy.
Yep.
And...
Sexiest coach in the world.
Shit. Who's the other one?
I didn't know that Bill Snyder went to Kansas State.
Yeah, they were still wearing leather helmets. he established football at Kansas State.
I feel embarrassed. This is why I'm like worried about everyone on a game show. Like, I just totally froze up. I couldn't think of anything.
Okay, four coaches in the MAC. I'm sorry, five coaches in the MAC.
Jesus. No. I don't even know who all the coaches are.
Okay, I'll give you guys this. Mike New at Ball State. Paul Haynes at Kent State. John Bonamego at Central Michigan. Tim Lester at Western Michigan. Other coaches you guys missed included Sean Kugler at UTEP, Jeff Tedford at Fresno State, at Air Force, Barry Odom at Missouri, Brian Harsin at Brian Harsin at Boise State, Matt Wells at Utah State, David Shaw at Stanford, Matt Luke at Ole Miss, and Scott Satterfield at Appalachian State.
I'm just glad I got one, to be honest.
Coach, you are the winner in your prize that you can teach Josh's third period tomorrow.
Sweet. Josh, right. I want a lesson plan in my mailbox by 7:05. Thank you.
All right. Well, we are already running ridiculously over time, but we're going to keep going anyway. So time for some deep roots. We're going to start with the great – actually, it wasn't even a great game. It was a good old-fashioned beatdown in Stark Vegas by the Bulldogs over the Bayou Bengals. Coach, I mean, this is your wheelhouse. Man, LSU fell back to earth. What on earth happened to Dave Aranda's defense?
Well, they ran into what seemed like an unknown buzzsaw. Nick Fitzgerald just freaking lit them up, man. He threw two touchdowns and ran for two more. It was just a freaking clinic in option football. It was unbelievable what they were able to do. It was the largest margin of victory for the Bulldogs in the 111-game series. I mean, they just in all facets of the game up front, they were bullying them. There was just – I mean, there's not really much you could say, but just LSU got bullied.
Yeah.
LSU got pushed around. They got ran around. They got ran over, ran through. They couldn't do anything on offense. Harris Williams had 146 yards himself. He averaged 6.3 per carry. This is just the second time in 18 years since 2000 that they've beaten LSU. So that's insane. I mean, he was Fitzgerald was 15 of 23. To throw some more stats there,
Fitzgerald was. Was fantastic in this whole game. I mean, he ran for two touchdowns. He threw for two touchdowns. and he looked the part the entire game, and he has really come into his own in his second season as the starter.
I'll be honest. I was watching it, and I watched it for a little while before the Clemson Louisville game came on, and I was checking in. I didn't really watch much of Georgia, to be honest with you. There was a couple games I was more intrigued by, but it just every time I saw him, Mississippi State had the ball. They were gashing him. They were pushing him around up front, and it just seemed like LSU was just taking it. And it was very odd to see. And it's very odd to see how bad they actually were on the road. It just seemed like they were disinterested. And you know, this is the first big game of the year. I don't know why they were, you know, I don't count BYU as a big game, but I don't know why they were so disinterested. They always, you know, conference games never, you know, they always show up. But here's the quote that kind of wraps it up. Defensive lineman Greg Gilmore of LSU said, "I mean, I'm embarrassed. We're an aggressive football team, but we've got to play smart." So they got, you know, a lot of busted assignments, a lot of penalties. It's just ugly all around for Ed Orgeron's LSU Tigers. And quite frankly, I was just like, what in the heck was going on? And my second reaction was, Georgia's got to play Mississippi State next week. I'm legitimately nervous about Nick Fitzgerald.
You should be. Josh, what were your thoughts here?
Well, Ed Orgeron, one of the reasons he got the job after the impressive interim stint was saying that he learned from all of his mistakes at Ole Miss and he was going to turn over a new leaf and be a new coach. And, through three games, I'm discounting the Chattanooga game because that was an FCS opponent. Against FBS teams, they're averaging 17 points per game right now. At Ole Miss, his first year, 13.45 points. Second year, 15.66. And final year, before getting fired, 20.08. That tells me he continues to not emphasize offense on his team whatsoever. They were sloppy, 9 penalties again, 112 yards. This is just – I was a little surprised that they're even still in the polls that were released earlier today. Quite frankly, they got flat out embarrassed. Hats off to Mullen. Hats off to Mississippi State. But not exactly the impressive league debut for Coach O. And, I mean, there's – quite frankly, if I was the AD at LSU, he would be on a short leash because he had a chance at Ole Miss and totally belly flopped.
Yeah, you're right. And I think that, you know, I think it's doubly embarrassing, especially because they brought in Matt Canada and gave him all this money to, you know, run the offense. And, you know, he ran those Pitt offenses and, you know, say what you will about Pitt, but they had a pretty good offense last couple of years. And
they had a great offense.
Yeah.
And that's what baffles me is how bad they came out and how many penalties.
I mean, Darius Geis is as good a running back as, you know, you'll find in the country. And
I think the world's just trying finally figuring out that Danny Etling is not this all-world quarterback. It took
them that long. I mean, if he couldn't even hack it at Purdue, what made people think that he was going to be able to hack it at LSU?
He played a few good games. He got hot and won the job, and now everybody's thinking he's the guy. And honestly, I think, you know, they have some offensive line issues. You know, they're not offensively; they're just not as talented as you would think, or sometimes that they lead you to believe. I don't think they have overly elite receivers. I don't think, you know, their offensive line plays consistently enough. And it's not Canada's schemes that's the problem. It's going to take a couple of recruiting cycles to really get some dudes in there. Defensively, they don't have any, you know, talent wise, they don't have any issues. I don't know what's going on that side of the ball, but maybe they just had one of those games where, you know, everything goes against you. But they got some things going on program wise. They need to get figured out, but they need to recruit better offensively, and they just need to, I don't know. They just need to find a way to get some focus in there. So,
all right.
Overall, embarrassing for LSU, but I don't want to take away from what Mississippi State was able to accomplish. Nick Fitzgerald, a freaking wonderful game. Put on a clinic again, like I said earlier. So I don't want to take anything away from Dan Mullen and Mississippi State. But, God, my God, LSU. I hate that we're talking about LSU so much and how bad they are. But,
well, you know what?
My God, were they bad.
Let's head up the Mississippi River then to Memphis, Tennessee, where the game of the week, the best game of the week, was an early one on Saturday. But, man, that was fun. UCLA, Memphis, you know, I hate to see the Bruins lose, but – good Lord, that was an offensive explosion. Anthony Miller from Memphis, who has the Vanderbilt anchor, I noticed, tattooed on the back of his arm, which is strange enough as it is that he plays at Memphis, but has like the exact anchor that Vanderbilt has as their logo on his, tattooed on the back of one of his arms. The former walk-on was an absolute beast. 9 catches, 185 yards, 2 touchdowns. The quarterback there at Memphis, Riley Ferguson, threw for 6 scores. Josh Rosen had 463 yards and 4 scores. This was an offensive explosion and a defensive coordinator's worst nightmare. Josh, what's going on with UCLA's defense, man? They can't stop anyone.
Yeah, they don't know how to tackle. They're just out of position. And, this has been an ongoing thing. This has been systematic, really, of UCLA the last few years. Once they had some incredible defensive talent head up to the NFL, whether it's coaching or not developing or not having recruits pan out or not scouting and getting bad recruits, for whatever reason, last few years for UCLA defense just is totally no-showed. And what's really, really, really scary, if you're a Bruin fan, is Memphis wasn't even that efficient in their game plan. In terms of their performance, they were 3 of 12 on third down. They had 3 giveaways, and Memphis had 10 more penalty yards and 1 more penalty than UCLA. I mean, they had 11 penalties for 109 yards. If Memphis had polished that stuff up, this would not have been a close game.
Coach?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It was one of those where both teams early could have probably ran away with it. But both teams really just fought themselves back to the pack. I think, there's one point where I sent a text that, oh, okay, here UCLA's waking up now. They started kind of slow because it was a 9 o'clock kickoff as far as their body clock goes. And I was like, okay, well, here they go. They're going to wake up now. And, at that point, I think it was 17-7. I think UCLA just went up 17-7. And I was like, okay, here we go. They're starting to wake up now. We're good to go. And then all of a sudden, bam, as soon as I said that, Memphis marched right down the field. Bam, 17-14. And then bam, bam, bam. It just seemed like they started trading touchdowns and things started going crazy. And defense, it was almost like they were going on air. Every time they touched the ball, they scored. And it was both teams. And I was impressed with the resolve of Memphis and not really allowing themselves to be overtaken by a Pac-12 team or by a Power 5 team, I should say. And, they have that attitude where, hey, nobody can beat us, especially at home. And they played lights out. They played the rest of that game almost flawlessly. And, it just seemed like, two touchdowns that I really, because I was in and out of that game too. I was kind of flipping around and I was watching my own game film from Friday night, and I was doing a lot of different things. And I wasn't watching as intently as I usually do, but I noticed a couple screen passes they had scored on. It was it was a thing of beauty, though, what Memphis was doing.
Yeah, I mean, going forward, you have to like this Memphis team. It was a shame we didn't get to see them against UCF a couple weeks ago, or last week, I should say, because of the hurricane. But because that's going to be a great game. I think that game has been rescheduled for some point. But they it's been rescheduled for 2 weeks from now. So that'll be fun for them, because I think that those are, you know, part of the two strongest teams in the American East. But Memphis is actually in the West. I'm sorry, but two of the strongest teams in the American in general. So let's keep it. We got to keep moving. We got a lot of games to get through, so we're going to try to power through these last four games. First of all, USC over Texas, double overtime. That ended up being a ridiculous game. Josh, thoughts here on SC pulling out victory?
Yeah, pulling out victory and a little bit of a red flag for the rest of Pac-12 going forward. SC dominated Stanford by running all over them, but I just don't think this receiving core is quite good enough outside of Deontay Burnett. You know, there's no Juju Smith-Schuster. There's no, like, game changer. And when you bundle down their running attack, they were pedestrian looking. They look beatable if you slow down that running game. They only had 71 yards on 37 carries. I think that's the blueprint going forward.
Coach?
I was really impressed with Sam Darnold down the stretch. 28-49, you look at the stats alone, not overly efficient, but 397 yards and three touchdowns, that's getting it done. And then the freshman kicker, you know, welcome to the league, buddy. Kicking a 43-yarder to end the game, and you know, USC gets a little bit of result. Little bit of revenge, I should say, against the Longhorns.
Yeah, you know, I think there's definitely a silver lining here for Texas. You know, Sam Ellinger had to start for them in place of the injured Shane Bouchel. And, you know, he completed, you know, just over 50% of his passes, but 298 yards, two scores. You know, not exactly the most efficient game, but kid's a true freshman. What I'd be concerned about Texas, though, they can't run the ball. Man, 35 carries for 68 yards. Mm-hmm. It's less than two a pop. That's bad. So they've got to do a better job of getting the ground game established. Next, though, what was billed as the game of the week ended up being kind of a snoozer. Clemson absolutely shellacked Louisville. And Josh, is no surprise to anyone, it was all about Clemson's defense.
Exactly. And it's funny you mentioned it being a snoozer. It sort of the same time as the Mississippi State game. I was so curious to see how the Bulldogs looked that I totally forgot to ever flip back to this game. And then when I finally was like checking scores on my phone, it was already a blowout. I was like, oh, okay, I guess I didn't miss anything. But yeah, Clemson just blew open that game in the second and third quarters. That was really impressive. And I got to be honest, based on checking Clemson's stats in this game and seeing them against Auburn last week, and it's kind of seeing a little bit of that Alabama-Colorado State game, I think if there was a rematch tomorrow, I would take the Tigers without a worry. They look amazing.
Absolutely. Coach?
Yeah, I mean, Kelly Bryant might honestly be just as good and pose just as – I think he might pose – more of a threat to Alabama's defense than Deshaun Watson does. I know that's hard to say, and I know that, you know, if you follow me for a second, I think he's more of a threat on the ground than Watson was. Watson was a pure quarterback that could run if he wanted to, but didn't look to run first, wanted to beat you through the air and stay with his read. But Kelly Bryant has no problem running, and he does so well that, you know, he's extremely dangerous. And God almighty, I haven't seen a better – you know, I think Georgia and Clemson have the two best front sevens in college football right now. I think Clemson should be the number one team in the country. I think they're the best, and it might not even be close.
I wouldn't disagree with that. Clemson is truly, truly outstanding. I mean, that defense is a force to be reckoned with. Yeah, they gave up 21 points, but 14 of those were in garbage time in the fourth quarter. Penultimate game we're going to talk about, San Diego State, some late night football out there on the West Coast. Both of you guys picked this, Josh. San Diego State with the big upset over Stanford. They can thank their running game because, quite frankly, Rashard Penny is a beast.
Yeah, I mean, Rashard Penny is the real deal, like we thought he was going to be. When I previewed this team back during the Mountain West, I said an underrated aspect for their team is their quarterback, Christian Chapman, giving them just enough to keep the team honest. And that's what he did. 21 of 29, 187, a touchdown, no interceptions. That's just enough to give you a little bit of a pause, even though you know 9 times out of 10 it's going to be handoff to Penny. That's what Stanford's lacking right now. Keller Chris, 9 of 20, 72 yards, no touchdowns, 2 picks. It's not going to cut it. And I also have to question the play calling. 22 rushes for Stanford. That was it. 13 for Bryce Love. He made the most of those 13 carries, 184 yards, 2 touchdowns. How are you not feeding him the ball more, especially when your passing game is giving you nada? Lots of gut check moment here for Stanford. A lot of people look in the mirror trying to figure out the rest of their season.
The other thing here, Coach, is that San Diego State held the ball for more than 41 minutes. Stanford didn't even get 19 minutes of possessions, and that showed in the stats. I mean, Stanford ran 43 plays from scrimmage.
Yeah, you're not going to win.
I mean, that's like a quarter and a half for UCF.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to win many games that way, only running 43 plays. And, you know, that means either you're going – if you have 43 plays, you better – if you're going to win, you better have 50 points and a lot of one-play drives. But it's just – something's not right with Stanford. You know, they're – It's not, and I don't know what's going on because, you know, their schemes and what they have talent wise is there. I mean, that they're not any different than what they've been before. You know, Bryce Love is a tremendous running back. Maybe USC beat him twice. You know, I always say when you lose a big game like that, sometimes that team beats you again the next week because you're so down that you lose again. A game that you shouldn't. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much of it was Rashard Penny going off and San Diego State playing the game of their life, or how much of it was that Stanford played one of the worst games they've ever played since David Shaw took over. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know what to make of this.
I don't know. Stanford really needs to regroup at this point. But, you know, they don't have time. You know, UCLA's Airgill tax coming in next week. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, say what you will about UCLA's defense. It's not great. But
yeah, they just need to possess the ball.
But they can move the ball. So yeah,
they just need to possess the ball, get back to doing what they do, drive it down UCLA's throat, possess it, chew up clock, and put the ball in the end zone.
All right. Finally, quickly, I mean, there's not much to say about this ugly, ugly football game between Tennessee and Florida, except for that Felipe Franks is one lucky son of a gun. Because Tyree Cleveland caught that bomb to end the game. It was ugly first three quarters. Fourth quarter was fun, though, wasn't it, Coach?
Yeah, it was. It really was. I told somebody it was the worst 3.5 quarters ever, but the best fourth, but the best half quarter, most entertaining half quarter I've seen in a while. It was just like nobody wanted to win, and then all of a sudden they started trading blows. It really looked like a middleweight undercard fight where neither guy is really defending themselves, and you know it's just a lot of sloppy punching and whiffs and jabs, and then all of a sudden they start landing haymakers on each other, and one of them just lands that haymaker as the time is ticking away in the 12th round before they're about to have to make a decision and not really know what the decision is. And then all of a sudden Florida was the guy that landed the haymaker, and Tennessee just caught one on the chin and was like, whoa. And then I said to myself, I was like, oh yeah, Tennessee just got a taste of their own medicine.
Yeah.
Losing on a Hail Mary. Love it.
John Kelly is all that Tennessee has on offense.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, 19-41.
I'm sorry, Josh. I have to say this too. Why, when you get it first and goal from the one, do you not give it to your only bit of offense and take your chances on three straight plays and feed John Kelly the rock.
Ladies and gentlemen, Butch Jones.
Well, I was going to say that segues nicely to, you know, my thoughts on this game. I thought that these just look like two poorly coached teams that were just constantly out of position in that fourth quarter. They each had three turnovers, each had a slew of penalties, you know, just mental mistakes left and right. Tennessee went 2 of 5 on field goals. So, like, no special teams. They tried two different kickers. The Hail Mary or whatever you want to call it, the busted coverage. I mean, last time I checked, safeties pretty much have one job, but that feels really unfair to leave it on the safety considering Tennessee didn't even bother to, you know, have more than two safeties on the field, you know, not really being in a prevent defense, just kind of lollygagging around out there. Like, I mean, what are these two teams doing? Neither one looks well coached.
Nope.
The safety spun around completely in a circle in that play. It looked like he looked like they said, you go out there and play safety. Coach, I never played. I don't care. Go out there.
Well, I loved that the corner let the guy go deep because he ran up and covered, I think it might have been the tight end, who was running about a 6-yard route. So that was useful.
Who cares about the tight end? You can't, I mean, you could let him run 20 yards and he'd probably trip over his own feet.
I mean, the tight end is always open unless you're Tennessee defending a Hail Mary at the end of the game.
Well, on that note,
the tight end should be always wide open. My God.
On that note, we're going to have to end it for the night, gentlemen. We all have to get up very early in the morning. So on behalf of my amazing 5-0 picking against the spread co-hosts, Corey Burton here in Nashville, Tennessee, our coach, and our intrepid blogger from Big Ten Accounting, Josh Cook, in the Windy City, this is the professor saying so long and see you next time on the Illegal Motion College Football Podcast.
See you next time, boys and girls.
Thanks for listening to the Illegal Motion College Football Podcast. To get in touch with the show, email us at illegalmotionpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at @illegal_motion.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.